Hello everyone, it's Chris Hall here from Charity Digital, the organisation that helps other charities be more digital. Today, we have a special podcast for you. In March, we had over 400 charity professionals join us at Olympia London for a day of learning, knowledge sharing and connecting. We managed to record all of the 22 sessions from the day, and we'll be releasing them as bonus podcasts throughout the series to help share some of the amazing conversations we were having on the day. If you want to keep up to date with all our upcoming podcasts and events, like and subscribe the podcast through your usual podcast provider and sign up for Charity Digital updates at charitydigital.org.uk. Enjoy the pod.
All right, welcome everyone. I think we're just going to go ahead and get started. So thank you very much for coming in and joining this session. It's in the midst of everything that goes on in this space, and I myself have been in the not-for-profit sector for some time now. I have run small not-for-profits. I'm in a scaling-up not-for-profit. There's so many things that need to be fixed, and something that quite often can fall to the bottom is the idea of inclusion and diversity. And yet, what we're learning more and more, and business is learning more and more, and now the third sector is learning more and more, this is really cracking the nut of understanding what inclusion means, how we build more diverse teams. It's no longer something that is just a nice thing to do. It's not just the right thing. What we now know is there's a lot of evidence showing those organizations who are able to build inclusive, diverse teams are able to improve on the bottom line, greater return on investment, better able to survive disruption, digital disruption, move into different markets. And the gauntlet I often throw out into the for good space is also, we have a moral imperative, I would believe, that we need to make sure that when we are creating great services, great solutions, great breakthroughs in research, we need to ensure this is not something we are doing to our beneficiaries, but that we have beneficiaries in our team, people that represent the people we're trying to reach out to. So this is not just the business imperative of how do we make great new apps. This is about how do we create the most effective team? How do we attract the best talent out there so that in the third sector we can make that absolute difference to the people that we are trying to support? So what we have here are four really interesting people who are on the journey. Now, what I'm going to say to you now is I'm going to ask not Chatham House, but what we're going to do is we're going to have a conversation and ask you then at the end if you have some questions to throw some questions into the conversation. When I run something called the Tech Talent Charter. The Tech Talent Charter brings together organizations of all sizes, from all sectors and all industry around tech in relation to diversity and inclusion. And one of the things that I often try and say first off is no one is claiming to have fixed this. No one here is going to claim that they have the magic answer and what we're going to give you are the 10 easy best steps to fix inclusion and diversity in your organization. Everyone here on this panel, everyone who's joining things like the Tech Talent Charter is on the journey. This is a problem that is so broken, no single organization can fix it themselves. And so what we wanted to do today was to talk about things that within the third sector, these people are doing in their teams, whether it be their tech team because they're a CTO or a CIO, or within the organization as a whole, as a CEO, to try and move that dial, to create more inclusive teams and organizations, and to therefore have more diversity in their teams. So we'll start with some good news about what's going well. We'll grapple a bit with what's not going well or still hard, and we're trying to find solutions. We'll throw it open to you to see if you have some questions. Wherever possible, we're going to try and dig into the practical, all right? We're not going to try and prove to you today why diversity and inclusion works. If you don't know, see us at the end. We can show you some links on why it matters. And what we're going to deal today is to really try and think about how can we all get on the journey to make our organizations more inclusive and diverse. So my name's Debbie Forrester. As I said, I'm the CEO of the Tech Talent Charter. I'm going to ask each of my toughest question I often find when I facilitate discussions is this challenge I throw. I'm asking you to introduce yourself and your organization in 1 minute or less. And then also just to give a context, because I know whenever we talk about third sector, we're talking about very different sized organizations. So if you give us a sense of your organizational size, so those of us in the room can think about, okay, that's most like me in my context, if that makes sense, all right? And I have to say, Danny's been very good, so we're all sitting below our pictures so you can know who we are, so you can check and see if we get this right. So would you like to kick us off?
Well, I regret that now because that means I'm going first. So I'm Danny Attias. I'm the CIO at Antinolan, Antinolan UK Stem Cell Register. Give you a context, we are about 400 staff, 50 million-ish turnover, and technology team of 25 people.
Super, thanks. Ursula.
I'm Ursula Dalton. I'm the CTO at the British Heart Foundation. So our organization is about 4,500 employees, and I have a tech team of about 200, 220 people.
Super, thanks.
Hi, everyone. I'm Monica Shafak. I'm the CEO of the Kaleidoscope Plus Group. We're a health and wellbeing charity based in the West Midlands with a focus on mental health. We used to be affiliated to the Mind Network, but back in 2013 decided to disaffiliate. Our charity is very small compared to my colleagues sitting on the right-hand side of me. So we have a turnover of just over 2 million, and we have just under 70 members of staff. We don't have an internal tech team.
I'm Tiffany Hall. I'm the CIO at Cancer Research UK. The charity is about 4,000 staff, and I'm pro rata about the same as Danny, actually. We've got 260 technologists at Cancer Research UK, and the charity's income is about £650 million a year.
Okay. We're going to set some terms of reference. We're going to talk about either our organization as a whole, if we outsource that, or the team that we can wrap our arms around and that we have the most control over. And I also want to broaden the discussion. And, you know, one of the things that we found at the Tech Talent Charter, we needed somewhere to start, so we started with the lens of gender. And since we've moved on now into 2020, we're talking about diversity and inclusion in its fullest sense. And I'd like to, for the purposes of we talk today, this is much more than gender. Gender is important, but it is also thinking about ethnicity, neurodiversity, disability. We're going to put the whole piece together. So thinking positively, what are some things that are happening in your organizations that you think is starting to make a difference in trying to make your teams more diverse and inclusive? Does anyone want to jump in? Tiff.
So I think diversity and inclusion has become a huge increase of focus for Cancer Research UK. Since I've been there, we've been putting a lot of weight behind that agenda in the charity as a whole. And talking to one of my colleagues who's been there longer than I have, he was saying how different it feels than how it did a few years ago in that context. All of the executive have got diversity and inclusion objectives, personal objectives that we're being measured against. In terms of success story, I'm very pleased and proud that in technology, despite the charity sector being incredibly white, at Cancer Research UK Technology, I'm at about 36% BAME, Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic, and at about 40% women. And when I talk to people not in the charity sector, they say, how do you get so many women into technology? I say, join our sector. Yeah. There's so many women compared with banking or, you know, wherever the person I'm talking to is working. Yeah.
And it's like two things that I'm hearing, Tiff, that are really good is, and what I've seen in talking to all of you, is there's never a sense of complacency. You don't do diversity and one day get your badge and you go on. It's not a vaccination. So it's that lack of complacency of, okay, great, if we're 40% women, now what are we doing on other things? And the other thing that was really important is that setting of targets, you know, that measuring and putting it into people's job roles that makes a real difference. What about the rest of you? What other things are you seeing that's happening?
I think for ourselves, there's been a big push on equality and diversity because that's important to me as an individual anyway, but it's also part of the organisation's ethos. But for us, since we've made some significant changes to our board, we've got a wider range of people sitting on our board, not just in terms of demographics, but the skills that they bring to the board, because there's diversity in skills as well.
Agreed.
That has made a huge, huge difference. And I think it's really important, like you say, you don't just do equality one day and then forget about it until, you know, you've got a review in 3 months' time or whatever. You have to practice what you preach, and it comes from the top bottom. So for us, it's really important that we are showcasing that, you know, equality is really important to us, diversity is really important to us, and it's coming from the top bottom.
Okay, and this is another of the ingredients that we often hear when we're talking to people. You know, the charter is about gathering things, and you're building very beautifully on the sorts of things we hear about. You've absolutely got to have that top buy-in. And what I like hearing is it's not just at the CEO level that you're getting it all the way up to board level, because I hear a lot of companies that are paying lip service and they're getting better at management, but somehow we're still seating the white, male, and pale, stale boards, present company, lovingly included within the group. But I think you've got to have that C-level, and we have to see people like us at those levels and that C-level, as then going into the data and the targets. What other things are you seeing?
I mean, from the British Heart Foundation, we just got our brand new CEO, who is a lady CEO we have now, as well as they appointed me new to the executive level just 10 months ago. So we brought diversity because we didn't have that voice of technology as a skill set in the executive level before. So that was really important to us. But then going back to my directorate, as per with TIFF, we have about 40% gender, like females, in our directorate. And I can't say I have the measurements for the BAME number because it's still optional. So if they don't actually actively provide that information, we don't catch it. But when I look around my area, I see a lot of different colored people, and I think that's brilliant.
Absolutely.
Because it brings that diversity.
And I do think that gathering the data, it needs to be handled sensitively. We need to look, and I think things like when they are going to look at the relation on ethnicity and the pay reporting, that will help pop another one of those little bubbles, pull the plaster off where we talk about it. But data is important, isn't it? It is really important as we get larger, not to just rely on, it feels kind of okay, I think it's okay, do you think it's okay? I think we're okay. Yeah. It's that looking deeper, but it's finding the right conversations and ways to do it. And until we can formally measure, it's about always doing those sanity checks and looking around.
I think we, it's never okay. It's just constantly flexing and changing. In our organization, we have a female CEO who's been at the helm for over 10 years. The vast majority of the executive layer are female as well. That and as you said at the beginning, you know, that's not the end. That's just the beginning. We need still more diversity across the whole organization. I made two offers to programmers yesterday, so I now have a 50% female split in the development team. So just the programmers.
Well
so
done.
That's a bit, you know.
Okay, now that if we were in the tech sector in the private sector doing that, that would have resulted in a gasp going across the room. 50% women, etc. Because it's just you're not hearing that.
Yeah, it's easier in the business analysts, project managers, testers, and so on, but actually coders, and almost, if not all, have either come from scientific backgrounds or other backgrounds, retrained as developers or from within the business and been redeveloped. And so we've got a real variety. And we've got people there from 1 month to 32 years. And most of those, including 32 years, have completely retrained, even though they were developers before, but retrained their development skill set to the kind of modern world. So we're getting more value rather than going, well, they've passed it. Let's just go and get some fresh new developers in. They've got the institutional knowledge, the experience, absolutely, and everything else of the organisation.
And I think really, Jenny, that's one of the game changings I'm hearing from across the sector is this looking at alternate routes into tech.
Yep.
Because if we know that the education system is such that it's still 16-17% women going through, really low numbers if we're talking ethnic diversity, whether we're talking disability, et cetera. We want to work on that. We're not abandoning what's happening in the pipeline, but if you wait for that to get fixed by Thursday, which it won't, it's going to be 10 years. So this retraining, returners, career conversion, going other places to find our candidates is really transformation. I love what you're talking about, that conversion within. All right. There was a great story. I can remember someone talking at BT who was saying they had somebody, because they were really putting some effort into the retraining. And one of their great breakthroughs is somebody that had run 15 years running their call centers was on the production team for their new chatbots. No, there's nobody that's going to have that kind of really in-depth user knowledge than someone in that piece, so that conversion piece. Now, that's not an easy thing to do. Are some of you looking at these alternate routes into your tech teams?
We are definitely, as you, we try to bring in people from the business into the technology area as much as possible. However, we are not that mature with getting the apprentices, getting the interns, getting the grads, because I'm really desperately trying to get the apprenticeship program going, and it's hard to convince my management to yes. actually really accept that. Whereas we are starting our first ever grad scheme this year, so it's that start. And that cultural shift, that's the challenge.
It always comes down to that in the senior piece.
I just wanted to talk briefly about apprentices as well, because I had quite a lot of trouble convincing my own team to embrace apprentices as an entry-level pipeline talent pool. Mm-hmm. And I was really worried that the apprenticeship levy, which I'm sure many of you know about, but is effectively a tax on employers with a pay bill of over £3 million a year, this money that's given by our supporters for us mm-hmm. to spend on cancer goes back to the Treasury if you don't spend it on the apprenticeships, and that's not what our supporters were giving us money for. We have a moral imperative to spend that levy mm. and not hand it back, in my view. So we started with two sort of admin apprentices, and it was rocky at first, and then they flew. And with that helped turn around the view of my colleagues who there was an overhead of having apprentices, no question, but we've now got them in the help desk, end user compute, business analysis, and software engineering about to start, which I'm childishly excited about. And it is very interesting from a diversity point of view, not just on ethnicity, but also, of course, crucially on social mobility, absolutely. Which the charity sector is poor at. I mean, I'm sure many of us saw hashtag charity so white. We could just as well be saying hashtag charity so posh, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And I think, so what I'm hearing, if I'm in the audience and I'm thinking, okay, retraining. So the first thing is I've got to assemble that business case, and I've got to win the team to the why. A chair that isn't fully filled 5 days a week is better than an empty chair. Mm-hmm. That this is how we do move diversity. I get that buy-in, but I also heard as well, it's thinking in a startup fashion, starting very small. I'm hearing that from both of you, because I think, Ursula, you said you only did this when you started with apprenticeships. You started quite small as well?
Definitely. I mean, looking at the apprenticeship levy, we've got a couple of people doing their MBAs. So we thought actually that's a way of retaining people, especially I identified a couple of flight risks when they get into senior positions. Yes. And I thought, okay, how can we convince them to stay with us for the next 2 to 3 years? Great MBA. Fantastic. And things like that. But so we are identifying our top flyers. Basically, how can we retain them? Then also at different levels, how can we actually bring people into the organization at certain entry levels? So there's an exercise going on to that. But it is starting small and convincing everybody.
And it's also knowing it's going to go wrong to some degree. And I think it's pinning people to that idea of, you know, whenever companies are starting something new, and particularly around diversity, you have to walk that through, because, you know, if they bring in someone who's a returning mother, or they're bringing in someone from and it doesn't go right, you get that, oh, that's the last time we do. But I've never, you know, everybody's done a bad hire. You know, I know in my career I hired some bad left-handed people, but nobody said, you know what, we're never going to hire people who are left-handed ever again. It's getting past that mindset, because somebody feels other. That then if it doesn't go right, what are some of the things that we're doing? So when you're trying these alternate routes, what are some of the things that you found that were working that made a difference?
Well, if you're not making mistakes, then you're not innovating, you're not challenging, you're not really pushing things forward. For us, bringing people in who have retrained as developers was a bit of a gamble, because we were at the time we were using an outsourced partner to do the majority of our software development, so that we could get going. And it was a bit of a gamble. We brought people in, and the first one kind of went slowly. Do we know how to manage them? Are we going to give them enough capability to grow? Are they going to want to stay? If you try and hire a React front-end developer, they're really expensive. But if you get one that's only been, you know, 12 weeks earlier was a musician or a zoologist, which is what we've done, then they're really cheap. And we know we're not going to keep them forever, but that's okay. They've still got an affinity with the sector, affinity with a particular charity and the cause, and they might pay back further in future. So now from that one, we're up to five. We no longer do any outsourced development for our front end. So all of the people are internal. They kind of live the culture and the passion of the organization. And they're working with the business every day, helping them develop their front end. But we took that gamble. We didn't think we had the capabilities to manage front end developers, but we tried it. And we found this source that every, where we get them from every month, there are 40 graduates every month. Last week we went and we said, who wants to come and work with us? And 31 of them said, yes, please. And we couldn't take 31 people. So we just had to choose two. We did go through a process, but quite frankly, you could have hired any one of those 31 people and they would have all been. So we know now there will be a churn and we will miss them, but we can always get fresh blood in all the time. We'll get better and better and better at onboarding them. And that's worth doing.
And there's something I think that's an interesting idea to start exploring in the sector, and it's not just third sector, but looking across, this is such a huge problem. And there are some organizations that do have the bandwidth to begin doing things, but not to be able to then hire everyone. Yep. And I do wonder if there are opportunities to start thinking about how larger third sector organizations might start collaborating with smaller organizations to think about retraining and returners. Mm-hmm. And I also know that some of you are quite cunning in the way that you're thinking about how you work with private sector partners and alternative routes. Do you want to talk that through? Naming no companies, but what are some things that if I'm running I'm third sector, that I can think about my corporate partners?
I think we maximize on that one because we had to look at, okay, there's a attraction, how do we recruit them? Then there's a retention challenge. So one of the key ways, because we can't pay the packages that the private sector pays, technology is technology. It does not matter which industry you are, it's the same technology. It's the package that is different. So the best guys go to the private sector. So what we did was saying, let's make another give them another incentive. So we've identified our portfolio of work, and whether they are apprentices, whether they are graduates, or whether they are coming as actually skilled personnel, saying, we are working with these corporations, and our portfolio is actually delivering items in collaboration. So that's one way of doing it. Especially with the likes of graduates and things, what we're doing is actually talking to certain big industry partners saying, can we do placements? So why not you guys send your grads to work with us for X number of weeks, and we'll send our grads to work with yourselves for X number of weeks. I think that's another way of actually attracting and retention, because one of the selling points is, if you go to one of those corporate partners, like, say, one of the big tech companies, you only work in that one tech company. Coming, joining us, you get to work with a number of tech companies. I do try to sell that in the interviews.
And it's interesting for us, isn't it? Because I think both of you were doing an event where we had someone from Lloyds Bank.
Yeah.
And they were saying, actually, there's a real trick to be had insofar as they know that there's lots of people who are working in private sector doing it for the man, usually a man, that are very interested in giving back, in the meaning, the purpose. And so the chance of getting in front of a lot of those people is really powerful.
Yes. To add to that, just last week we had an innovation session called The Pitch. So we actually opened it out to the organization saying, who wants to work, come up with ideas? And we had four big tech companies actually mentoring these teams and working with them, and the actual product is going to be hopefully delivered in collaboration with them. So it's that co-creation. So it's not just for the new people, it is for anybody, and it was not only for technology, it was organization-wide. So we attracted lots of others into it as well. So you probably saw it on LinkedIn where we were actually. I think it's amazing for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think any relationship that you have with any partner, whether it be a corporate partner, another charity, with the community, it has to be a win-win, no matter what the situation is, no matter what it is that you're giving one another. Because, unfortunately, the third sector is seen as the poorer relation, and we have to bring that perception back up to actually we've got something to offer to you guys as well. So when I'm talking about partnerships with people, it is very much about Yes, you can do that for us, but we can also do this for you. So if there are issues around equality and diversity within their organisations, or, for example, they need support with wellbeing for their staff, we will go in and we will do that. So even when we have fundraising partnerships, it's not just about, you know, we'll go in once a year, collect a cheque and say, thank you very much, see you again next year. That is not what we want as an organisation. And I don't think the third sector wants that. Mm-hmm. And being working in that way will hopefully raise the profile of third sector organisations and kind of diminish that view that we haven't got something to offer, when in actual fact we have a very good amount of things to offer.
I think that's really important not talking ourselves down.
Yeah,
you know, I'm new to the sector, only 4 years in, and I just, have all the prejudices that everyone, you know, and you come in and you go, oh God, this is really hard. This is real work. And and we make that clear to people when they're interviewing. We try and take people from whatever sector, it doesn't matter, charity or otherwise. I mean, when I get recruitment companies telling me that, oh, we exclusively focus on the charity sector, I'm going, great, next. Why would I be interested in that? I want from anywhere, including charity. And so we shout on LinkedIn, because that's not just charity, that's across the board. And one example I can give you is we have got a software development partner for our back-end development, so we do half in-house and we do half with them. And these guys are kind of 250, 300 developers, really, really high quality, incredible caliber. And one of the metrics that they use is how much the individuals and the teams enjoy working on the projects and the companies. And we constantly get ranked the top of the companies that they work on.
Fantastic.
They feel they're giving back. They're still doing tech. Mm-hmm. And they're working with genetic algorithms and things they'd never think they'd be doing. Yeah. But they just really enjoy that whole level of engagement.
And I think there's a really interesting opportunity. If we go back to sort of what we were also saying with the apprenticeship levy, there's a lot of companies that are already, you know, they want to find ways of using their apprenticeship levy. And there's some interesting opportunities that as third sector, you could be saying, use it on us, work with us, do this together. And several third sector could be going together and doing that. And nothing's going to be perfect. Nothing's going to be an easy fit. But it's worth starting to ask these interesting questions, thinking about what you're giving back, because again, it's giving a wider range than they might be able to do. It's the meaning, it's the purpose.
We do that in January. We started a large internet-based travel company. is using, they just can't spend their apprenticeship, but they make so much money. They've got so much apprenticeship.
It's a horrible world, isn't it? Actually, really.
So they're like, well, we don't want to give it to the Treasury. You can have it. And we had five people start an 18-month-long data fellowship program. So
fantastic.
Specific data analysts. There was a whole application process, and they're now following. They're developing their in-depth knowledge of data science, and they're working with the likes of Datakind, who are here today, who are brilliant. And we do hackathons with them and get the business involved. So it just really gets it out there. And then now they have a network. Mm-hmm. So they have a network from this training. They have a network from Datakind, and they're not all charity networks. Some are astrophysicists and neural scientists, and they can pull on that network and just grow their learning, grow their capabilities all the time.
And there's some interesting capacity on thinking how different charities could be working together to do that with companies. And it is an interesting thing to have in the back pocket, because I don't know about you, but when I've run it, you're forever having a company saying, oh, we'd love to give you money, but we think it'd be much more valuable if, and then give another thing. And the idea of you can give us your apprenticeship levy, you can plug us into your apprenticeship program is a really interesting offer. And again, can I go back to Tiff? I was really aware of what you said, and I don't want us to slip by this. There is this issue of, not only is the accusation that we're only looking at white, but that we're very middle class. Mm-hmm. What is it we could or should be doing in the third sector if we're going to be inclusive, going beyond just that posh label? What is it we can do? Is there things that you've encountered?
Yeah, so one of the things we started doing a couple of years ago in charity was paying our interns, and that made an immediate difference. It meant we brought fewer interns in, because the departments now had to bring it out of their own budget, but that made an immediate difference to the demographic, and I think that was a really important move. We've just started talking about shaping up a returners program, which I think could potentially also help us, but I really don't have a silver bullet on this one. I mean, I just think it's a big problem for the sector, and I think it's one that we should start talking about more as a sector.
And I think it's also being willing to go to different pipeline, mm-hmm. because I think it's we have typical ways that we do things, yep. and what's the definition of insanity is doing the same thing every time and expecting a different outcome.
Yeah, and I was very struck by a staff session a couple of weeks ago where one of the people was telling a story about how she was in a hiring situation internally with a promotion, and there was a conversation in the team about, well, so-and-so wouldn't fit in. And all your alarm bells should kind of go off at this point, isn't it? Particularly when it comes to things like neurodiversity and other ways in which people don't fit in, and the risk of us all hiring in our own image, both internally, internal promotions, internal movements, but certainly kind of externally. And I think if I look back to some of my previous hiring conversations in previous stages of my career, when it had felt okay to refer to cultural fit as being part, yes. of the selection criteria, and now here in 2020, I look back on that self of myself of 20 years ago with a little bit of horror and think, actually, that's not an acceptable term anymore.
No. And it is still out there. I still hear, yeah. again and again, oh, I'll hire for culture over skills any day, that sort of piece, that cultural fit. And I think it goes back to, again, where we started, which is the culture of the place. Mm. And really bottoming out, culture is not just how we dress and how we look. It's something much deeper in that. And in a smaller organization, Monica, you have that opportunity to wrap your arms around culture in a way that sometimes larger organizations. Was there anything that you did that really made a difference in terms of setting a culture that makes it more inclusive?
I think it's about having open door policies. It's about being, you know, having that environment where everybody knows that they can talk about whatever it is that it might be bothering them, ensuring that you're, like I said, practice what you preach. Your website looks inclusive. There might not actually be any LGBT individuals within your organisation. There might not be. I mean, we personally don't have as many men as I'd like to see in the organisation, and that might be because of the service that we provide and, again, the stereotypical view that, you know, men don't work in the care field. So that's a challenge for us. But, you know, the things that we can do, the perceptions that we can give will help and attract different types of people. I mean, also sharing our stories with not just mainstream media. So are we going to a place like The Voice, The Asian Times, and,
yes.
and those kind of media outlets as well?
And it's the new channels and places. Yeah. It's getting out of our comfort zone to talk about who and what we are.
But it's also looking inward. So if something's not working right, why is it not working Good. Right? So if we're doing a survey, for example, and it's around, you know, demographics, and you've got 50% of people saying, I'd prefer not to say, mm-hmm. that rings alarm bells. Mm. Why do they prefer not to say? What is it that is about the organisation that's stopping them from saying, I'd rather them say, this is what I am or this is what I'm not, mm. end of. And they will know that that's not going to go anywhere, and it's not going to affect them in any way in their place of work.
And so it's creating those safe conversations, yeah. Yeah. to move on.
The one, it's interesting, two things that you made me think about. One about LGBT. Mm. We're a very open and diverse mm. organisation, yeah. And we've been at Pride for several years in a row, and I'm kind of leading the parade and take my wife and daughter with me, and that's great. So that absolutely no barriers at all. But then you mentioned accessibility, mm-hmm. and then I think, well, actually, we've got a lady who is deaf, and we've got a guy in a wheelchair, and you go, well, hold on, that's components of it.
Yeah.
What about our design? What about our website? What about and when we're trying to do development, we're trying to think: is it functional?
Yeah.
Will it deliver value? Will it be performant? Will it be secure? What about data privacy? Mm-hmm. What about access? Oh, yeah. There's so much to think about, but you have to keep reminding yourself again and again.
And it's and that goes back to why we need inclusive teams.
Yeah. Yes.
Because
exactly.
we need people there who it is automatically brings those questions to the table, mm-hmm. brings that lens of what we do. Now, I've got loads of other questions, and we could carry on going for hours. I'm mindful that we've got some in the audience. I'm supposed to remind you that there's the microphone here and there's one back there, because there's been a lot of sort of dashing to the front. If you have some questions, would anyone like to sort of bring forward a question to ask? Brilliant, from them. Very good.
So thank you all, first of all, for your insight. That was, I'm not talking into it, sorry, God. I've never been too short for a microphone. So hi, I'm Colette. I run a brand and strategy consultancy called Brand By Me. Thank you all so much for your insight, because it's been really helpful. My interest in D&I is one personal. I grew up in the charity sector, so and I'm keen to see the sector move on that level. But also from a brand point of view, in terms of just helping organisations use their values, I think you mentioned it, Monica, and really embed D&I into how they do things. And that's my question, is that I can see, Danny, you talked about like being at Pride and kind of big moments and big events and big activities and having an apprenticeship scheme and things like this, like big activities around D&I. But how do you integrate inclusion into more everyday conversations so it's not a separate stream of activity? Yeah. That's my question.
Which is a super one, because there is that sense of, oh, we do D&I, we have a department who does that, the outsourcing of inclusion, etc. Mm-hmm. What do we have some answers to that?
I mean, you go ahead first.
Yeah, well, just this can sound like a really silly little thing, but it made an impact on a couple of our team during. So we have a guest Wi-Fi with a sort of slightly scrambled word, you know, with weird numbers. During Ramadan, it said Happy Ramadan or whatever with suitable ats and this, that, and the other. And before it got changed to, I don't know, Wimbledon or whatever it was, but and just. You know, somebody's like, oh, I'd started and I felt really welcome. It was in my first week. And you know, that was took no effort whatsoever and made several people feel good. We also did guidance for line managers on the kind of adjustments to offer to their staff if they wanted who wanted to observe Ramadan. And we celebrate and mark in other ways lots of the different celebrations from different faiths.
And I really echo something you touched on there, because we agree that it's vital to get it at the top level and the CEO and the board and all of that, but actually so much can go right or wrong at that middle management level, and it's that training and support that turns into the little conversations, the little things, much more than the big policy piece.
I think the other thing is also doing it in a way that it feels natural. So when we look at my leadership team, I'm originally from Sri Lanka, and I have a person who is Irish, who is South African, who is Bangladeshi, who is English, and I think it's when people see that as that is the leadership team, that also sends a message, and we take pride in the fact that we come from different backgrounds, different nationalities, and I think it's that taking pride in what you are, and especially as a leadership team, that just sends a stronger message as well.
It's also having that conversation about it's a Friday afternoon, or are we going to the pub, or and it's not, we're never going to go to the pub because there's one Muslim member of the team, but it's making sure there's a balance in it, and we just consider that during Ramadan. I remember last year I bought boxes of dates, you know, for everyone who's observing Ramadan within the team, and being of kind of North African Israeli Jewish descent, it just starts to open up a conversation rather than keeping it in silos.
It's keeping it human, keeping it small, and also I think creating space for sometimes for people to get it wrong and have the conversation. And I think it's about making sure that everyone feels they can have a role in this as allies, as champions, as supporters, as well as, it is creating that and allowing that there will be mistakes. People will use the wrong pronoun. People will get the right things. But a gentle pulling up of, oh, God, yeah. Sorry. And keeping that going. Do we have one more question? Yes, sir.
I guess I'll try to come around. Hi, very interesting. I've spent a lot of my time in a big private tech company, corporation, and also with autism causes. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to do now is research starting up a purpose-built, inclusive, creative agency combining for autistic people.
Fantastic.
And the point about it is to look at the strengths.
Yes.
The thinking differently and how that actually can help the creative process, and also the idea that those they would be making things for their own audience. So it's all that process. I'm trying to work out how this would work in a practical sense. So the question here is more practical. So if you have people who are less visible in terms of disabilities and things, how are you able for them to get the support they need? Not just workplace adjustments, but really how do they work side by side with other people on digital and tech projects? How does it, do you have a sort of process? How does it come to life?
We don't have a process, and I think one of the things that makes a huge difference for how a colleague with different neurodiverse characteristics, how they can work with the rest of the team, makes a big difference if they're willing to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So once people are able to talk about it with their line manager, that helps enormously. But it helps in my team, I find it even more helpful. Mm-hmm. If the rest of the team, their peers, know about it, because the risk otherwise is that the rest of the team start rejecting that individual and, mm-hmm. and not being inclusive towards them because mm-hmm. they're not making mm-hmm. Allowances and are not focusing in on the strengths that that difference brings. There's still a societal tendency in the UK, and we're no different, to not be comfortable with some differences. And I think in the tech sector, it's pretty well known that there are characteristics around, say, autism that lend themselves very well to certain roles in tech that, say, test and related things of intense discipline and rigour. But I don't think we've got that accepted in teams well enough. Mm. In my own team, it's where the line manager knows and I know. I find that helpful.
It goes back to what I was saying about culture, creating a culture where anybody can talk about whatever it is that they want to talk about with their line manager, but also the line manager kind of respecting the bits that they might want to keep confidential.
Yes.
So it's not always about sharing everything, but knowing that that individual is supported in the right way, particularly by their line manager, is really, really important.
Your answer is so much better than mine.
there's some interesting organisations that are beginning to play with this. So anything from, there are some organisations that will work with companies who would like to hire neurodiverse people to both help adjust the whole interview process, working with line managers, bringing it in. But there's also another one that runs through AbilityNet, and they're going to kill me that I can't remember what it's called. But they have a tool that an individual can go in and any of the predicted characteristics and explain what their needs are. And then what it can provide someone with is not the why, but what they need. And this idea almost that all of us may need some adjustments. It's almost flipping it into, well, you're the one that needs adjustment, is that we all have some adjustments and it will require interest. And some of it's because we have a protected characteristic. It can be from background, it can be from any. It's that culture of support and permissiveness, that bringing your whole self to work, but not having to explain it all, I think is really important. It's, the person can own the why, but explain the how and decide how much of the why they want to give.
Yeah, there's the understanding. It's a complex thing. You may not have had awareness of it for the people who are not autistic, for instance. And also for those who are autistic, they may lack the usual means of expression. So they need another forum to do that, to develop this communication. The idea maybe of a sort of passport or something to help facilitate.
And I'd urge you to get in touch. This is one of the things why for the Tech Talent Charter, our goal is to connect the dots. So anyone who is doing stuff in a space, we try to connect them. So by all means, reach out, and I can put you in touch with some others who are working around the neurodiversity space, because I think it's powerful. I think people are starting to understand some areas that in the past we'd seen as disabilities come with a huge range of what I've heard them described as superpowers, really valuing it.
I suspect the likes of Google and Microsoft have absolutely got this nailed. No problem at all. They know what they're doing in this space. Yeah. But I think we talk about recruiting in our own image. We talk about the interview process and do they fit our cultures? Would they get on with the team? I'm thinking, well, hold on. You're recruiting here for really technical tasks. Just because they don't make eye contact with you in the interview does not mean that they might not be a perfect fit. And there's a lot to think about.
It's going back to first principles.
I think that is the answer, isn't it? Once you've got diversity within your team, you don't have to think about it all. You've got the thought constantly happening in everything that you do.
All right. I mean, one last thing, and then I think we're going to be carried out of the hall.
Danny's remark reminded me that within Chance Research UK, we have an internal talent development program for anybody in the charity, and there are certain things for the people who we think are the senior talent of the future. And it was really geared towards people who were incredibly eloquent in doing presentations and interviews. And we've just been pushing really hard to get that adjusted because it was really swinging in one direction.
Not just for the extrovert, but for the rest of humanity. Listen, you've been a fantastic audience. If you haven't had a chance to ask a question, please come up and talk to my wonderful panel. You've been lovely. Thank you very much.